Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 407th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Matt Urie. You can check out his website, mattuhry.com. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Carlin Hudson back on the mic. She's a returning guest. We've had her many, many times. We just had her on our New Year's panel just recently, and I thought to myself, dang, we didn't get enough Carlin. So we asked her back to talk about a handful of things.
Yeah, mainly festivals. Sundance is going on, and whether we should care or not. And we also talked about shot lists and if they do or do not define who you are as a director. And I very much enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, it was great. You know, if you like this show because you feel like you don't get to hang out with directors enough, you just want to like talk shop, dig in on a few topics, talk about what's been going on in your life, this is an episode for you. And I think that honestly is a lot of what people like about the show.
Yeah. And I do think we kind of go from indie filmmakers to commercial directors to just general filmmaking on this episode. So I think everyone has something to enjoy.
The question is not just like, should I make an indie movie or not? But like the bigger picture is like, is networking important? Are networking hubs important? What am I missing out on? What's important? What isn't in my career? Whether that, and that's applicable, whether it's commercials or indie films or everything in between.
Well, if you care about these types of things and you want to keep hearing about them, we would really love for you to go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/justshootitpod. We can throw $1, $2, $4, whatever you want per month to help support this podcast. Matt and I have just decided we will endorse your website at the very beginning of the podcast episode, if you have one, or your Instagram channel, whatever we can find.
Do you want to make it? Is there a minimum for that? If you're like $4 a month or more? Or just nah. Don't worry about it.
Everyone.
Yeah. Okay. Sick. I like that.
So, you know, you'll get one extra thing. We're going to go through our existing patrons already and obviously like endorse their sites as well. I don't want people to be penalized for not already for having been patrons before. We love you all. We appreciate you supporting us. It really does help us keep going. When we see the email from Patreon that we have a new patron, it makes us very happy.
Our hearts flutter.
Anyhow, patreon.com/justshootitpod. Check it out.
Let's hop into our conversation with Carlin Hudson.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Carlin Hudson back on the show. Welcome, Carlin. It's been so long.
It's been two weeks.
Yeah.
The last episode.
It's been too long.
Episodes for you. We have a handful of awesome topics that we've already set up for the listeners at home. So we'll jump right in. As of this recording, it is Monday, January 15th. Sundance is imminent. So it's on its way. And we're already getting those emails of like, hey, can we circle back when I'm back in town? That sort of vibe. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about it for a couple of reasons. First of all, I always get a little frustrated around this time of year because, as I was saying, I'm like ready to go. I'm jonesing, you know, we've been back for a little bit of time. And like, the last thing you want to hear is like, hey, I'm going to be gone for X amount of days, work days. And like, it always feels like it takes people like 6 weeks to catch back up.
Maybe because they literally get sick. But it feels like it. Because they all get sick.
And they're traveling and then they tack something on and da 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 da. And like maybe they're there for a super long time. And then before you know it, South By is coming. And it just feels like, oh, no one's actually working in this town for except for like 3 months.
Just for some clarity, can I, like, obviously there's film people with films at Sundance that go to Sundance. I'm assuming these are not the people that you're talking about. Not getting back to you.
No, I'm not like annoyed that the Daniels aren't emailing me back.
Right. Or who do you care about that is going to Sundance and getting sick and not responding to you?
So this is a perfect segue into the second part of the question, which is, do you have FOMO and should we be there? And to answer your question, Oren, agents, right?
Yeah.
Which tend to be there a bottleneck in terms of all sorts of important information, specifically in my case, offering actors roles, right? So if they're out of office, they're not returning, or they're out schmoozing or things like that, things noticeably slow down. And then the other thing is that investors and producers, in particular my producers, are also going to Sundance. So if a bunch of agents and a bunch of financiers and my producers are all in Park City and I'm not, of course I'm having FOMO, not just because I love movies and I love film festivals, but because it feels like I'm missing out on connections and business opportunities outside of participating in the festival, right? Like I used to, the common adage is like, don't bother going to Sundance until you have a film there. Which I think is true to a certain extent, but also we all know so many people who met someone, or rather even like, you know, solidified a relationship that they had in LA or they had somewhere else, but then they're just, they were at a party or, I was, you know, watching the game with someone. I ran into someone at a bar, you know, and they come back to LA with a rock solid, you know, relationship because people are there to connect about independent film, the thing that I am the most passionate and focused on right now.
Right. And so you already predicted my thoughts on this, but to me, it seems like independent film, if that is the thing you're working on, like feature film, then there's a huge value in going to Sundance. I think between the three of us, we've been to Sundance 4 times, and I don't think any of us have had things play in the Sundance Film Festival.
I didn't direct it, but the only time I went, I was the co-producer on a movie. On a feature.
Oh, right.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And you did have something at Sundance.
You did have something at Sundance. And also, as an easy example, that was Computer Chess, right?
Yeah.
The filmmakers who made that movie, you still see their names on stuff
all the time
to this day.
Yeah,
all the time.
Shoot, what's their name? But they're huge in independent world. Sam, somebody, I forget the EPs. We'll connect about it later. You can look it up on IMDb. But sure. Yeah, it's like these guys who financed a bunch of Andrew's films. They're always there.
I had a script in the slam dance competition.
Oh yeah, that
placed. And so they gave me a pass to go to Slam Dance for free, which of course was like the only excuse I needed to go to Sundance, which happens to be at the same place at the same time. And I believe I used the Slam Dance pass for zero movies.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure people know this about Sundance, but as someone who is like has a much stronger relationship with South by Southwest, which I played three times and like I go to all the time, I also lived in Austin. Like when you have a South by Southwest pass, you get to get into movies, but at Sundance, you have a Sundance badge and you don't get into anything except for some like lounges. So that's what's so strange about Sundance too. It's like just a different beast altogether. You know, you like have to have tickets to barter and you stand in the line and it's this whole, it almost feels like it's more about parties sometimes than it is the movies. And that to me can be frustrating. Now I'm just talking shit about Sundance.
No, but to Matt's credit, it's about the networking.
Yeah.
You know, like that's why you go to Sundance.
Yeah.
And that to me, like, you know, you talk about adages of not going there, you know, until you have a movie there and kind of the history of Sundance and should we be there? But to me, I don't know, ever since COVID, like it's kind of lost its luster. And people, I think most of the movies that sell, like people are talking about before the festival. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know that there's so many discoveries of like things that nobody had any idea about. It's impossible to get into see the movies. The parties are pretty hard to get into unless you're super connected. It's really cold. It's really, really cold. Expensive.
The cold's no joke. The cold does make
it
so
cold.
Just much harder to like finagle anything.
And lodging is so expensive. It's like you can sleep on my couch for $300 a night and you're like, what? Right. See, no joke. Like that's not, I wish I were exaggerating. But yes, I do have FOMO.
Yeah, so that's the real question, Carlin, right?
Yeah, I think, really, I actually, did I say this on the last episode? But I didn't. Maybe I was talking to someone else. I was talking to Christina Archer on her podcast because I was like, I was late to this thing because I had to re-upload Instagram to my phone because I took it off when the Sundance announcements came out. It made me so depressed. I was just like, you know, the old adage, compare and despair. And I was just seeing friends' movies and I was telling my wife, I'm like, well, Sundays. And she was like, babe, you didn't submit anything. And I'm like, I know. And yet I wish that I was had a movie in there. You know what I mean? But I truly didn't submit anything. So it was just ridiculous. So I took Instagram off my phone, was much happier. Today, I took it back off my phone because I was like, well, fuck me. Sundance is actually here. What's worse than the announcements? Mm-hmm. People's movies actually playing there. Yeah. And so it's like not, just to clarify, it's like my friends that have movies there, I'm happy for them, but I also wish I had a movie there, you know? And like,
you want them to have movies there. You just also,
absolutely.
It reminds you that you don't have one. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Being there without a movie, like, is, to me, the only, like, I think for you, Matt, it maybe makes sense to be there just because you have a script, you are attaching cast and you're raising money and you have a list of types of people that happen to be at Sundance that you really need to meet right now. Mm-hmm. But if you did not have this, I feel like if someone was like, hey, here's a free ticket to Sundance and free lodging, I don't think I would take it. Unless they also said here's five movie tickets and six parties and all your friends are going, like it's such a job.
It's a shock. Yeah, for sure.
Well, yeah.
And I agree with you for the most part. But I guess in the back of my head, because we all know a lot of producers who go every year, you know what I mean? And they always have a couple things they're kicking around and they're trying to, you know, even if they don't have like the script that they're that it's their front burner. They always need financiers. And there's a part of me that was like, well, I used to be a person in my younger years who would knew everyone, mm-hmm. especially like when there was like a web space, you know, like you, there were concentrated scenes that you could plug into and get to know people, and who knows how you could help them or they could help you. Right. But you have to show up in order for those connections to be made. And you guys are right. All of those aspects of like the lodging and the snow and all that stuff is really daunting, but it is also a place where there are, that's a concentration of people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's really helpful if you know someone that works at the festival.
Sure.
The very first time I went, my friend was a volunteer there. Hmm. And he took tickets at the press theater, mm-hmm. and he just would let me in for free to every movie at the press theater. The small
wow.
theater
was like
a pretty good friend.
Yeah.
That's,
it was like
yeah,
me and Roger
cool.
Ebert and like 10 other reporters. Yeah. It was like not in demand because you couldn't buy tickets to it, you know?
Wow.
I see.
And so, and it wasn't a huge theater. It was like, it probably was like a 40 person theater or something like that. But I didn't know anyone, you know, I just mm-hmm. moved to LA except for him, but I would hang out with the interns and stuff. And he could kind of, he figured out, he was also like the lowest intern on the totem pole. But he just happened to have the perfect job for me. So I saw a lot of movies. The second time I went, that's when, you know, I knew some actors that had movies, and my friends, John and Teresa Gulisarian had a Duplass film there, and they got us into that movie. And we went to the after party, and it was fun. But I also went with like a big group, like mm-hmm. like eight mm-hmm. people or something, and I couldn't get everyone into the parties.
Totally.
You know, and they were, half of them are not film people at all, which is like so annoying. Don't take those people to Sundance with people.
Yeah,
because they're like, we don't want to go way. To like a panel. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, guys, go skiing. I'll see you tomorrow, you know?
Yeah, no kidding. I'll text you if I can get you into a party. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's like, you've been to South By, like, yeah, so many times. And, you know, I don't know. I guess I feel like you're really having FOMO. Like, you really wish you were there. And, like, what would happen? Like, unless you're trying to set up your movie.
I don't wish I were there. I wish I had a movie there. Which is different, you know. Sundance, even though my filmmaking style is not a total shoo-in for Sundance, because it's mm-hmm. just sometimes I'm like, I don't know, it's not like navel gazy enough or like dramatic mm-hmm. enough or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, I
or
like
star-studded or whatever. Yeah, like they
yeah,
have
like. Yeah, exactly. That said,
there's a personality to what they're programming, right?
Yes. And that said, it's like, who doesn't want Sundance on their resume? You know what I mean? It's sure. just like, it feels like it kind of catapults you. And I know that that's not totally true, because I know friends who, actually I have a friend, maybe I hope he doesn't listen to this, but he, you know, he lives in Austin. He had a movie at Sundance maybe 10, 15 years ago. He's teaching out of college. He's made some other movies. They haven't gotten to Sundance. You know, did it totally change his life? Not really. It did for maybe a couple of years, but he never really turned into anything after that. And look, he's not dead. It could still happen. You know, this is a marathon, you know, I don't mean to say that he's not going to continue to make stuff that gets into Sundance, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. It's not a golden ticket. Right.
Right. But it feels like it, and still, it still would be nice. It'd be a nice feather in the cap, you know?
So outside of the, I don't want to use the word jealousy that we're all feeling, or at least Carlin and I are feeling, but that sort of internal conversation aside, from a business perspective, as a director, do you feel like it would be valuable, Carlin?
I do think if I had a movie ready to go. I mean, I guess I do have a movie ready. I have a couple movies potentially ready to go, but I just am so frustrated by this status of them that they don't feel like fresh. I have like one Sundance story that's not my personal story, but one of my like mentors is Jamie Babbitt. She directed, but I'm a Cheerleader, has directed like hundreds of episodes of TV. She told me her Sundance story. This is also with big caveat that it was in the 90s, but she had made a short.
Pretty important caveat.
Yeah. Pretty important caveat.
Which was the heyday of Sundance.
Yeah. That's true. But, you know, she had made a short film that got into Sundance. And when she found out that it got into Sundance, she hired a graduate student. I can't remember if it was like UCLA or USC to write the feature version of the script based on her outline. And she got the first copy of it like days before Sundance. And it was terrible. And it was shit. But she didn't care because she was like, I'm going to meet someone to finance the feature film version. And I want to be able to say I have the feature script. And it worked. Mm-hmm. She got money and then she made But I'm a Cheerleader the next year, which is nuts.
And I'm pretty sure there are still stills from that movie in my lookbook.
Really?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's great. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yes. So I do think, I don't know if I had like a proof of concept for something and a feature. Yeah. There's a world in which, or like my producer or actor I was really friendly with and they wanted me to come because they wanted me to kind of like, they wanted to network with me. I think it, so there's like, right. I think there's a sort of X factor of like when it would make sense.
What I'm hearing, Carlin, because you have plenty of movies that like definitely could, if someone was like, here's a check, you just pick your favorite, but maybe it just sounds like you're not especially excited about the hustle of like the indie grind specifically, right? Like that you've kind of been doing the studio thing for long enough that like that's the path now.
But is it working? You know, this is a different conversation because I don't know. I don't know what the answer is for me exactly.
Sure.
Indie versus studio.
Movies, yeah. Making movies is a complicated situation right now. It's pretty hard. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do think like film festivals are different. You know, all these festivals you can attend virtually now also. So
I think
the camaraderie and the like exclusivity and the like, whoa, we're all here freezing our asses off together is like not as cozy maybe as it used to be. And it could just be that I'm older and like less excited by the adventure of it all, you know?
Yeah, totally. The wind just cuts through a little harder now.
sharing a room with two other people was truly fine when I was in my 20s. And now I can't even, you know, I'm like particular about the hotels that I stay in. So it's just a different sort of, we are in a different era, you know? Are you still like, Matt, are you still excited about like the indie hustle, the grind, like as you say? Excited about's the wrong phrase, but are you still willing?
Willing, certainly. Yeah, I think. Though, you know, it's easy to say that. And to have not been confronted by like the size of a crew. You know what I mean? I think it's easy to be like, yeah, for sure. I can still hang. And then when you're trying to shoot a movie in 14 days or something like that, being like, well, this is impossible. You know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So we'll see. But I think I've still got it in me. I'm pretty confident I do. Mm-hmm. And that it's more about making sure the ambitions of the script don't overreach whatever budget ultimately we end up with. I do have anxiety about like going out to talent right now, and I know what the budget is, and knowing like Creature Comforts might be lacking in a way that like from a commercial perspective, certainly they will be in comparison. You know,
Creature Comforts for you or for actors?
No, actors. Feeling self-conscious of like, oh, if you're asking a movie star to come and like they
can't afford a trailer,
exactly. That's a perfect example. Yeah.
Or they're like their particular glam squad, which costs $20,000 a day.
Yeah.
So exactly. Simply an untenable amount, you know?
Yeah. Just like, oh, that's just not this movie. Yeah.
Though I wonder if like on an indie film, I mean, obviously on commercials, people demand having their $20,000 a day glam squad. But I think on an indie film, if you agree to do it, like, you know, maybe you want to approve the makeup artist, but I don't know that people are expecting to make, you know, $5,000 a day.
Totally.
Indie film. Right.
Yeah.
Like, that's totally true.
And they get it. You know, like if you cast like Zach Galifianakis to be in your indie film, he's not going to demand a $20,000 a day glam squad.
Sure. Zach might. No.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of beard. A lot of
he does
beard
a lot
work.
Of beard to trim.
On the topic of film festivals, our editor, Noah Bashor, or Bashor, no one is quite sure.
Could you ask him?
Yeah, he said it's Bashor.
Nah. We don't talk to him.
I think that's a clear answer.
It's pretty concise, yeah.
He texted Matt and myself today about his film. He's got a feature film he finished. He's applied to film festivals. He's a few festivals have told him, like, hey, we're excited to program your film. He's waiting to hear from, like, some bigger ones first, I think.
Sure.
But he was asking, and it's a small film. It's like it's his first indie feature. But he was asking if we think he should get a sales agent now before he knows where he's premiering and all that stuff.
Oh, interesting. I think if you're not at one of the big festivals, probably not.
Interesting. See, I almost wonder if it's the other way around. I mean, my answer to him was we got my first feature, which is the only indie, like the second feature I did kind of had a deal set up in, before we even made it. The first feature, we did get a sales agent. We paid him $25,000. This is in 2010, so I don't know how much it costs nowadays.
Yeah, yeah.
But he did not end up leading to the sale of our movie. We got distribution and everything. Yeah. It had nothing to do with him. And
did
I
he
was
help
like,
with festival strategy or anything like that? Did he? Were there?
No. He like advised on like some connections and things. He was. You know, he was kind of like this, like he also knew some people that we knew. And so it kind of helped that there were two connections, you know,
that's kind of dovetailed. But
I know we had Glenn on the podcast who works in that. And he seems like a honest and fair and decent guy. And so, yeah, can sales agents help you get into festivals?
Yes. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, they definitely can. Yeah. And also help with festival strategy as well. Imagine if you just knew a filmmaker who their entire livelihood and bread and butter was distributing films. Of course, they would be at different festivals and they would have their own set of connections. And that's part of what you're buying in on, right?
But you think a sales agent can help you get into a festival?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really?
Well, they can probably get you submitted past a deadline or... Hey.
Yeah, or put in a good word or recommend festivals that maybe aren't on your radar. The right. thing, and Carlin, I'm going to assume that you haven't listened to the Glenn episode.
I'll have to do it.
Carlin said she only listens to episodes where we interview people named Carlin.
That's
fair.
True.
Fair.
I listen to them a lot, actually, because Carlin's have good advice.
Glenn represents a very specific size movie. He helped sell See You Next Christmas. But like, you know, if you're premiering at Sundance, I think Glenn would love to help you out, but he would probably admit that he's not the guy for that movie. Do you know what I mean? I think he has rep movies of that.
Right. He probably has rep the smaller indie films, but not the like $2 million indie films.
Yeah,
right?
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe he has.
Or the $10-15 million. Dollars. Who knows? Right. He's had a long career. I'm sure he's repped everybody. But the point is that he specializes in smaller movies. And so those smaller movies, sometimes a new filmmaker will be like, well, yeah, I applied to all of the festivals, Sundance, South by Southwest, Tribeca, and we didn't get into any of them. Right. And so in that case, you know, somebody who's been around can recommend a few festivals that are right for a film of your size, basically.
Mm.
That's the situation there. The tricky thing is that, like, and I think all sales reps worth their salt will tell you this, they can be honest about whether or not they're optimistic about you making your money back on this movie, right? Mm. So small movies, you know, they have a hard time. Like if you don't have an A-lister in your movie, it's hard to make your money back on any sort of movie, right? But like there is like the hope that when you make a movie for no money that you can make your money back.
Yeah.
But it's still pretty darn hard.
Right.
Because not that many people watch movies that don't cost any money.
I didn't even think of making money as part of like this whole equation.
Part of the sales rep?
Yeah, to me it was like,
what does a sales rep do to you?
Gets you distribution so people see your movie and then hopefully you can make a bigger movie next time.
Sure.
I think to me, I don't know. I feel like that's everything. Yes, sure. Someone makes a movie that goes to Sundance and they sell it for $20 million. And it's like, you know, it's amazing. But most people, I think, even that premiere at Sundance are not making a ton of money, you know, like a small indie film that doesn't, you know, get big distribution out of Sundance is maybe makes its money back like on the, you know, some movie channel or I don't even know who IFC Films, who even buys indie films anymore.
Sure. Yeah. Well, fewer and fewer people, but that's the other thing that a sales rep is going to help you with is like not just introducing you to a distributor, but keeping an eye on what your deal looks like and guiding you through that so that maybe you have a fighting chance of making that money back.
Do you pay them? Do you pay Glenn like upfront?
So this was going to be my question to Carlin, actually. So Glenn does charge an upfront cost, which I know some people dislike very much. Glenn is also a lawyer. He helps look at your contracts and things like that. And he's straight up about like, listen, if he's only making a percentage of your gross and your movie doesn't make any money,
he doesn't have much of a business.
He doesn't have a business, right? And so he does charge a modest upfront fee for sure. But CAA doesn't. Gersh doesn't. Right. You know what I mean? Like, so in the big leagues, but that's also because they're going to take 10% of a $16 million Hulu deal or something, right?
Right. But also they won't rep your movie. And even Glenn, I think, will watch a movie and say, this isn't, you know, I don't see how, it's not obvious to me how to sell this movie, so I'm not going to rep it, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So Carlin, what do you think of sales reps who charge an upfront fee? Have you experienced that at all? Have you heard of that?
I have. You know, I feel like I made my first little feature so, feels like so long ago. It premiered in 2016. I don't know how long ago that was, but
so a lifetime ago, right?
A lifetime ago. we did talk to sales agents and I don't believe that we ended up going with one simply because we just didn't have the money. You know, we were like, I feel like the lowest quote we got was like $2,500 or something. And we were like, we don't have $2,500. You know what I mean? So we didn't do it. And we ended up getting like very small distribution through Gravitas Classic. Are they even around anymore?
Yeah, big time. Yeah,
big time. Great.
Yeah. Gravitas also like has made a push into like more like higher budget films, actually. Like they've got marquee movies that like get max deals and stuff.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So we ended up kind of doing it just DIY style. Yeah. So I never did it. You know, we never pulled the trigger there. I don't know if that's uncouth to say nowadays, but yeah. So I don't know. I feel like when you're making such a small movie, you probably don't have that much money. So it's just kind of a wild business model to be like, I don't know how much he charges and maybe you don't want to say, but even if it's like $5,000 or $1,000, it's just kind of a lot of money when your whole budget was $50,000, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Which is, I think most people you can have a frank conversation with them. Like you have that consultation where you lay all of it out and like, then they can kind of help guide you. Because I think there are plenty of people also, for better or worse, who, to Oren's point, aren't as worried about making their money back, right? They're like, hey, I saved up, you know, I work a job as an editor for this company and this is my shot and I want people to see this movie.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to get it out there. And that's problematic on a whole other level. That's not really the purview of this podcast, but like you have to be clear with what your goals are, I guess is what I'm saying when you talk to those people.
Mm-hmm. So Noah's considering it. Considering the potential.
What he told me was that he's fine to kind of wait to see what festivals he gets into, but some of the other people on his team are antsy to kind of see things happening.
Right.
And he thought maybe a sales agent could accelerate that in a way, see what potential deals they could get, give some advice on if this is sellable at all, and also like maybe grease the wheels at a festival or two that is kind of above the ones that he kind of has these guaranteed.
I mean, he should get a consult, right? Maybe he should talk to a couple of them, at least get their feedback, right? Will they watch the movie for the consult?
That's a good question. I think so. Though I would guess, I can't speak for Glenn or any other person in that position. I bet you know in about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Or maybe just in terms it's of like a script. You watch 10 minutes and then you just go to the end.
Yeah. Like, okay, like you get a sense of what the aesthetic is and who's in it and what the vibe is. And, you know, if you've been around the block enough times, you know who is going to be, who this is going to appeal to at the very least, whether you sit through, you know, all 83 minutes of it or whatever or not.
Well, Noah, I hope we have thoroughly not helped you.
Maybe. What's your gut say? Yeah. I feel like I feel like you should talk to at least two, if not three, however, right? Mm-hmm. It's like I bet people have wildly different quotes and approaches. And as a new homeowner,
my guess is it's not a huge industry. My guess is that there aren't thousands of sales agents that sell a kind of micro budget film, you know?
Yeah.
So you maybe talk to all of them and it might be five.
Glenn,
Liz Manischel, our pal Liz Manischel.
Oh yeah.
Besides that,
you know what? He should talk to Liz and charge. Liz should charge him a small fee to give her knowledge. I think she should do that. I think that's what they should do. I'm not kidding.
That is the thing she does.
Yeah,
you know that's the thing she does. Okay, well, Noah should talk to Liz.
Yeah, that's how she makes her living.
That seems like a good in between. Ha! I'm like, what a great business idea I have for Liz.
You should consult.
Yes. So maybe that's the kind of thing he needs more than like a true sales agent. It's like sort of a festival consultation overall.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, good luck, Noah. Let us know.
Matt, do you feel like we've covered film festivals enough?
I feel good. Yeah. Yeah.
Something that actually makes money
for
something that actually builds a career for us.
I mean,
directors.
Carlin, how many times have you been South by Southwest?
Three.
No. Obviously, film festivals are amazing.
Right?
Yes.
Truly, beautiful career. Yeah. I'm just saying, like, just to put a pin in it, I think the hard thing about independent film is that there's a halo effect around making things and getting accolades and awards and all of that stuff. And that's really hard to quantify. And Oren, I know that drives you insane, right? You could make a movie that doesn't make financial sense for investors or for your life savings or whatever, that can still be very meaningful to your career, even if it's not like, oh, well, now I'm the Daniels. Right. Just because your movie doesn't sell to A24 doesn't mean that it doesn't help your career. But it's really hard to be like to pin down specifically in what ways it's helped your career. Right.
Right.
Yeah. No, it doesn't drive me crazy. I mean, I love film festivals. I think they have a huge place in our industry.
We know the roles we play on this podcast. Right, Oren?
Yeah. Yeah.
I like it.
No, yeah. I think they're great for breaking in, and I think they're great for kind of nurturing artistic pursuits for people that are like kind of stuck in overly commercial things.
Yeah.
But I think to me, the thing that's most exciting for me to talk about on this podcast is just like the sustainability of like a directing career, you know?
Sure.
And I don't see film festival playing a huge part in that unless you work for the film festival.
Hard disagree. Right. Because it still fuels your notoriety, your reputation, all of that stuff, right? Like we always joke about how sweaty it is to like write an email to say your commercial contacts, new year, just checking in, right? But you know what's a sick thing to post about? Hey, I see you at Sundance? ?
Yeah.
Right, but see you at Newport Beach Film Festival? Like, if you're not to me, that's the thing. It's like, if it's not a top five, maybe top 10 film festival.
Well, that's just a marketing pitch though, right? Like see you at Newport Beach Festival ? Probably not, right? Even though that's a great festival, don't hate.
It is that, no, that that's it, what I mean. It's great. Like there's but like, Nantucket. There's
check
all these
out
great
my
festivals.
New short, award-winning short.
No, I wouldn't watch it.
Right. Even if it won an award at Newport Festival is an easy example of how like it's helpful for sure.
It's funny. I feel like there's nothing that turns me off more than like, look at my 12 award winning, like my short won 12 awards.
Sure. You can't, you know what you can't do is you can't like omit the embarrassing part. You can't be like, Yeah, 12 award winning, like the where you make the laurels very tiny or something like that.
Yes.
That's very bad. But if you're proud of a short and it did win some awards, maybe you don't lead with, you know, second place at the Newport Film Festival, but new work you're excited about, new short, and also it won some awards is for sure cool. For sure worth worth talking about.
I mean, you and I get a lot of emails from people, filmmakers and publicists, talking about people's shorts winning awards in smaller film festivals. And my guess is that you've watched probably close to zero of them.
Here's the brutal truth. The brutal truth is that anything you make, whether it is a commercial, a spec, a short, or a feature, it has to be fucking awesome. Right?
Right.
And so, like, everyone listening has something awesome. They're capable of making something awesome. And we all believe that we are capable of making something awesome. Otherwise, we would have quit a long time ago. Right? So that's like the given for every conversation we've ever had on this podcast, right? Like, it has to be awesome. Yes. And also, you need to be proud to talk about it.
Right. But we will only think it's awesome if it premiered at a top film festival.
But that's not, they go hand in hand though, right? Short of the week, a Vimeo staff pick.
That's true.
1,000 likes on that post. Oh my God, this is so cool. I was surprised. We went to high school together and this is incredible. All of that stuff stacks up, but it's got to be awesome.
In fact, well, now that you're note, saying that, oops.
Yeah. No, go.
Well, it's almost page. Like, yeah, I actually, when someone says Vimeo staff pick or short of the week, I almost think that's going to be a better movie than like an award-winning short film at whatever the fuck Laurels. Festival.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. So those two things, now that you say that, I'm like, oh, there tends to be like a quality to those. And it's a little more, it feels like slightly more equitable than film festivals too, because we all know that film festivals are also political in their own right. Mm-hmm. But like getting the email of the Vimeo staff pick people, there's some politics involved with that. But also, like, if they just see a fucking cool short from a new filmmaker, they're going to be like, hell yeah, that's a cool, look at that. That's different. You know, that's trying something new. It has something, it has a voice, it has a POV. So yeah, it almost, those two, those two feel more meaningful to me. I don't know why that's worth mentioning, but it is.
Well, and also I think you made me realize we're not talking about exclusively cold outreach, right? We're talking about building on your community, right? So people who I already know, for instance, or, you know, like your personal network, or you're always talking about posting on Instagram, right? And how that's like so meaningful for your career, right?
Oh, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely it is. Mm.
Sorry, Carlin deleted Instagram.
I'm like, what's Instagram?
Yeah, Carlin. Oren does really, really cool behind the scenes videos. He'll explain a part of craft or something. You know these videos.
I still look at Instagram on my computer.
Sure. But for people who don't follow Oren, you do post really awesome behind the scenes videos. You talk about craft, all that stuff. We're all saying the same thing, right? Like making something cool and then showing people it. And like, if you can get buy-in from third parties, whether that's 1,000 people that happen to know Oren and follow him on Instagram, or a festival programmer.
More like 2,000, but yeah.
Sure. Okay. Either way, you know what I mean? Like, we're all talking about the same thing. We're all just looking for ways to like amplify our work.
Totally. Well, I think not on that note, on the previous note of everyone having to make something awesome. And you know, short of the week and, you know, Vimeo staff picks, kind of finding people that have something to say and having a voice. I've been thinking a lot about that lately. I mean, I know every filmmaker, you know, thinks about their style and their voice and like what they have to say and how they say things and how they're identified. But recently I listened to two podcast episodes that actually I think were both Jordan Brady's podcast, Respect the Process. One was Tom Kuntz, who's a director at MJZ. Ooh. Jordan asked him for advice on people trying to get into commercials today. And he's like, I have no idea. You know, I got into commercials like 30 years ago. I don't know what people do today, but I can just tell you, don't try to make something that looks like every other commercial. Try to make something that is just you and whatever, and is super awesome. It doesn't even have to be a commercial, but if you make something that sticks out, people will find it. And the advertising people will already start trying to make things like that thing, you know,
if it, they'll if rip it you off is what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And he had another EP on the podcast, his last episode, the EP from Spears and Arrows, that was talking about the same thing. Like, if you want to get work, you need to make stuff that just feels like specifically you and unique and interesting and different, and just don't say the same thing everyone else does. And right now, you know, I'm working on a few different projects and I'm making shot lists and storyboards. And sometimes I just feel like my, like, this is where I can stick out, is by making cool shots, you know, like not just a two shot and then an over and an over, and then we cut to the next scene, like moving the camera in an interesting way, making interesting cuts. Like, you watch a show like The Bear, you know, it has like all these dynamic close-ups, you know, or you think about Edgar Wright that does these cool zooms, or you think about even, you know, like Portrait of a Lady on Fire with these like stunning, like, you know, blocking and like framing and lighting. And sometimes I'm just like, I pitch, you know, my heart out. I'm like, this is going to be awesome. And the camera's going to be dynamic and it's going to be this and cool transitions. And I'll put like 100 cool GIFs from iCandy or whatever in my treatment. But then when the time comes to making the shot list and making the storyboards, I feel like sometimes I'm uninspired, you know, it's like two kids eating cereal, you know, in a kitchen, like, you know, and I have to tell this story in 2.5 seconds or something before the next thing happens.
You could throw a, you know, a pro lens on a camera and like, and 15 feet of dolly track or whatever, and just like fly through a Cheerio and like swirl around and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but if I want to spend 3 hours on it too. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I also have to think about production.
Yeah.
Like how long it takes to do these things and how many notes I'll get on it. And I have to justify it to the client, you know, like in the agency. So I'm just curious for both of your opinions, like, just when you're doing, you know, especially short form stuff that has like a limit on how long it can be, like, just what's step one for making your shot list? Or maybe choosing shots is not the thing that makes you you. Maybe it's about performances, maybe it's about comedy, dialogue, lighting, whatever. But how do you find ownership in like shot lists, or like ownership of your style and your vision, I guess?
I like to think of like, what's the main shot? Like, what's the thing you want to build around, right? Like, you probably have, maybe it's the first shot, maybe it's the moment of inspiration. There's a moment, a beat that you probably have a shot you're excited about, and then build it around that, I think. Carlin, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I don't know that I've ever thought of a shot list this way, because to me, it's like a tool to communicate, I guess, in that way, now that I'm saying it out loud. Yes, it's a tool to communicate your vision so that you can make your day and everyone's on the same page. So I guess in that way, yeah, it does need to be more comprehensive about, or just more have some sort of POV, because otherwise it'll just turn out to look like everything else.
Right.
But I'm like, huh, I've just really never thought of a shot list. Like, how do I also, or do you just mean?
I mean, if you look at a shot list from Tim Burton or from Wes Anderson or from Ava DuVernay, you know, they probably, I'm assuming that looking at the shot list, like, and, you know, I worked with Mike Mills a fair bit. Like, I can tell from his shot list that he's Mike Mills, you know?
Oh, really? Can you give an example?
Yeah, I mean, I guess he has like a very specific way he writes descriptions and things, and he'll just describe things very plainly, like, you know, like the tall man walks through the door and like looks around. I think he's kind of like earned that in a way, but he'll make something all black and white, you know, or he'll shoot in 4x3, or he'll try to do something like specific. But also, like, I wonder if Wes Anderson is like, when he's making his shot list, he writes symmetrical frame in a symmetrical frame.
Yeah, I mean, probably, you know. Right? But even if he didn't, I think it feels like maybe we're talking about two slightly different things. There's the literal document that says something like, if it's a Wes Anderson movie, you know, lateral track into Bill Murray you know, 25 millimeter or whatever, you know, like, but we all know what that shot looks like and that it probably is symmetrical and that they, it moves on in cardinal directions because of the big picture that it's a Wes Anderson movie and that we've seen, we're all briefed on that. Right. And Carlin, I think what you were asking is really like, what's the POV? What's the take that's guiding, what informs that, that shot list, that document, right? And Oren, are you trying to make it clear just from that document exactly what you want?
No, I guess I can give a more specific example. Like I'm working on some cereal commercials right now. Mm-hmm. And there is like this whole adventure element that takes place in the middle of the commercial. These are 15 second commercials. So I have a scene where these kids eat the cereal and get transported to this different world. And I have 4 seconds to have them decide to eat the cereal, kind of thematically tie in the adventure they're about to go in on with this opening scene, and then see them eat the cereal and get transported to this world. So I have four seconds to do that of on screen time. And I have all these parameters. Like I have to see the cereal boxes in the very first frame and they have to fill up 60% of the height of the frame. Like there's all these, all these different parameters from the, you know, the brand, but I'm trying to add my spin on it. You know, like, is it a dolly push in? Do we whip pan? Or do we do a quick zoom out? Are we transitioning from this bowl of cereal to an item in the adventure world? You know, like a match cut. Anything I think of is like adding time, you know, to this thing. And so I'm trying to, I'm trying to not just have a two shot of two kids at a table with cereal boxes and then cut to a close up of a kid eating cereal, you know?
Yeah.
I'm trying to make it better than that. And I'm just having trouble. And that's one of my projects. Another one is I'm doing these commercials where people are looking at their reflection in the mirror, in the bathroom. And there's only like 4 angles
where
you can put the camera, where you actually see the reflection.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to make it in. Then I'll like go into shot deck and I'll type in bathroom. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is a super awesome angle from Wolf of Wall Street. High, looking down in this public restroom, you know, and I'm like, I don't know. I'm just kind of, it's not like writer's block in any way, but I feel like I have all these parameters I need to, these story beats I need to communicate and I want to do it clearly and quickly, but I don't want to lose sense of style. And I'm just struggling with that.
You make me think of
something you guys struggle with.
No, 100%. I think we all do. I think we're zoning in on specifically what you're dealing with. The flip side is I remember talking to Andy Radzuski, previous guest, who's a DP, about like a show that was like very trendy once upon a time, that everyone was talking about the cinematography, right?
Euphoria?
no, but it might as well be. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
to talk shit about any specific shows, but like this would be an example of, I think when a normal person, when a civilian says, oh, I love the cinematography in this, they really probably mean, I noticed the cinematography. And Andy would describe that as not best cinematography, but most cinematography. And I think that when I'm in Oren's position sometimes, I'm like, okay, so I got to have these kids eat this cereal. I am like, okay, we'll make it super wide angle and zoom through it and this and that. And, you know, let me call Oren and see about a VFX shot where we match cut and da 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 da.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, then you're like, this is, you could throw the kitchen sink at something, but is it tacky? Or is it that what's right for this, right? Like,
are you going to spend so much time trying to make this work and it's not,
and it's
going to
be
not exactly right?
It's going to be okay. And then the rest of your shots are all medium shots, right?
Yeah.
I actually like what you said, Matt, about like, what are the shots? What are sort of the hero moments that you're building to, and how do you support those? And I'm also, I don't know what your adventure one is, but I'm like, well, I would think too, like, what are some adventure movies that it's like, you know, is it like The Goonies? Is it like, I just watched that Peacock? Muppet Treasure. Sure. I just watched that movie on Peacock, This Will Destroy You. I kind of liked it, actually.
Did
it was
you like it?
So stupid. I liked it. Look,
you know, Paul Berganti directed it.
Yeah, it was. Previous it was guest. Yes. And I've been always wanting to meet him. But it's obviously it's stupid. But that it knows the assignment and it leans in so hard. And I just love a comedy that's like, we're a fucking dumb comedy and we're going to ham it up. And the third act is going to be bananas. Yeah. And Conan O'Brien was so funny in it. He was really, we were like, he's never been funnier.
Do you know that John Higgins, what the dark haired guy is the son of
Higgins.
Of Higgins from the Conan O'Brien show.
Yeah.
Oh, late night. Well, aren't those guys like all like Nepo babies? Yeah, yeah. Oh, a different one podcast.
One of them isn't, but
yeah. Oh, that's good. But like that's an, you know, that movie is obviously like if they go on an adventure. So I don't know. Like I would be, my brain goes to like, what sort of like in cinema, what are some hallmarks of things that really gets us into like what the genre is quickly in 1 to 2 shots so that I can just like, the audience is like, oh,
sure.
This is cool. I can relax.
Or the Jumanji, or
totally. You know,
I have that. Yeah, there's this show called One Piece on Netflix, which I really loved. It's like based on anime, and it's kind of like my reference a little bit for fun angles. But I still, you know, I also have this kitchen set that I can only shoot from like 2 angles.
Sure.
And
can you see also, the ceiling? You know, is there a ceiling?
There currently is no ceiling, but I could probably.
Could the mute? I mean, it's like, I also think there's so many tools in like a director's tool belt that's not just visuals, you know? Like, what's the sound? What's the performance? There's other things that like, you know, might be special, even if it is. I mean, one of my most successful commercials is a fucking Cheerio. I keep saying like, fuck tonight. The Cheerios commercial, that was just 2 cameras cross shooting static. Mm-hmm. That is all we did. We could do that because those are great actors and because the content was really funny. It didn't need bells and whistles. You know what I mean? It needed like 2 actors that everyone knows and loves and riffing on some serial stuff. That's all
I
that needed.
I love that spot of yours. And I think it's a different beast than.
Yeah.
It has super famous people in it. It's shot beautifully too. Like the location is that's a real house, right?
Yes.
On location. Mm-hmm. The lighting is amazing. And it's kind of about the tone of Breakfast, right? And do they mention about heart health? And you have this amazing CGB that is a component as well. Mine is much more like, think of like a 90s fruit by the foot commercial. Mm-hmm. It's so insane.
You know, or a Capri Sun commercial. You remember those Capri Sun commercials where the kids would turn into liquid metal?
God, those were awesome.
What was the purple stuff? Is that?
Sunny D.
Gushers?
But the Gushers commercials.
Gushers commercials?
Gushers commercials, the kids would turn into like a strawberry gusher or whatever.
That's right. Yeah, those were awesome. Great, too.
Just super wide angle close-ups. Dutch angles, neon colors. Love it.
You're also just, now I'm just giving you a pep talk, but you are so clued into like what works visually. I just think, I don't know, maybe you're just doubting yourself. I think whatever you pick is going to be great. You're a very gifted visual director.
Thanks. I guess the pep talk is helpful.
Well, good. But, yeah. I'm like, I don't know. My shot lists are pretty, I don't even really make a technical shot list anymore. I do like, I have an Excel sheet.
Well, you do storyboards, right?
I do storyboards. And then my shot list is really like photo boards. Mm-hmm.
But isn't your storyboard based on your shot list? Like you sit with the storyboard artist and you're like, well, first we'll do a wide.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So I do write it out first. I forgot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So today I was editing my storyboards together and I was like, I feel like it's most cinematography, but not good. It literally is push ins and pull outs and like reveal this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can already see my DP cringing and being like, so do I need to get a zoom lens for this? Because you're like, woo woo. You're like kind of zooming in and out and doing all sorts of wacky stuff.
I like burying a zoom. Yeah, it sounds awesome, Oren. And like pulling a zoom as you're moving the camera is sick.
You know what I need to watch? I should watch that Every Frame a Painting on Edgar Wright and just steal like the six best ideas he has.
Transitions. Shoot, know what transitions you're shooting. That's the secret of that video, at least.
Yeah. So tough when you have six frames to do a transition.
Yeah.
Yes.
Match cut.
Yeah.
It's the best transition there is.
Well.
Okay. Well, thanks. I'll let you guys know how it goes. I'll send you my animatics that I made today.
Great.
Starring my kids' voices.
Oh, that's great.
Aww.
I knew they would be good for something.
Before we hop into unpaid endorsements, new listeners may not be familiar with you. Where can they find you? How can they keep track of what's going on?
Well, I did out myself as someone who's not on Instagram much, but I am bad and I do check it on my computer twice a day, at least. It's just something about it being on my phone.
Yeah.
That's pretty
it's
toxic.
It's a prison. Yeah, it's going to ruin your brain. Do you keep people, do you post? Do you like let people know about your projects? New work alert, Carlin Hudson.
You know, I've kind of not been very good. I've been on set quite a few times since I've posted. And if somebody posts a story of me on set, I'll repost it. So.
Well, if you want to see a POV of an actor having a great time with Carlin.
She also has a website, by the way, carlinhudson.com.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really, my internet presence at the moment is like low on my to-do list. But yeah, I love talking to people as long as it's not, can I get coffee with you and you tell me how to make a career as a commercial director, then I'm happy to connect. Which I, not that I won't do that, but you know.
Yeah, for money.
You've been on the podcast enough times. You can be like, just listen to the podcast.
Just listen to the podcast. Yeah, yeah. It's true.
Should we hop into the endorsements?
Let's do it.
Unpaid endorsements.
I watch a lot of kids movies nowadays, which is kind of incredible because we've only been watching movies that are like at worst very, very good. You're not like, oh, let me dig up this C- from my childhood. You're just like banger after banger with my kid. We watched Babe today. When was the last time you guys watched Babe?
Is it good?
It's great. It's a masterpiece.
5 years.
Babe is incredible.
Yeah. Wasn't it written like by M. Night Shyamalan or something?
It's George Miller and Chris Newton. Chris Newton directed it, but George Miller produced it. George Miller did the sequel. He did Mad Max and a bunch of those movies, like all that stuff. And then had a detour in the 90s and 2000s where he did like Happy Feet, Babe, and maybe another franchise, but it just was like cashing checks, making kids movies. Babe was nominated for Best Picture the year it came out. And James Cromwell was also nominated for Best Actor. It's awesome.
What year did it come out? Like early 90s or something?
95. Right in the middle, 1995. And it's great. It's really fun. It's awesome for kids. It's a little scary, but my wife and I cried at the end.
Aww.
It's about kindness. If you're like, hey, if you're an adult who's happy to talk about Paddington, go back and revisit Babe. That's my endorsement. And then my other endorsement, I was talking to my co-producer on the movie See You Next Christmas, Beat Shaheen, previous guest, who is the most thorough person I know. And we had just gotten off like a call with like the residuals company because we were like unclear for See You Next Christmas. Yeah. We're kind of getting some clarification on a couple things. That I think that if she wasn't there, I don't know that I probably would have just glossed over it and not bothered to like set up a meeting and learn specifically how this residual point system works for SAG residuals or whatever. And I felt like a much better producer because of it. And it all boils down to admitting you don't know something. And I think it is the most valuable thing you can do. Is admit you don't know something.
I agree.
Like, that's just how you open up to learning. And as filmmakers, we have to be aware of a lot of different skills. We are generalists in many ways. And so when you don't know about wardrobe or set design or fabrication or whatever isn't your specific wheelhouse, you probably came up through a vocation. There's a lot of stuff you don't know.
And we get scared about that sometimes, I think. And accounting is terrifying to me. It's truly triggering. And I felt so much better afterwards. So that's my other endorsement. Recognizing it, own it, and also follow through and learn, you know, dig in on it.
What did you not know about SAG residuals?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. So the way that SAG residuals work specifically is they're on, there's like a point system that basically the amount of money you earn, there are thresholds that SAG has pre-negotiated for every single contract. So for every like a certain amount of money, you get 0.2 points.
You, the actor.
The actor. Yeah, exactly. So if you work 10 days at $125 a day, that would be 10 points, right? But if you went overtime, right, then you maybe would get bumped up into an additional amount. So you could have actors who worked the same number of days, but who earned different amounts of money, earning different amounts of points. All of those points are then combined, and then you use that to divide up against the a percentage of the gross income. That's the total pie that gets sliced up and then distributed to people, right?
And is it true that the SAG residuals get paid out before the investors get paid back?
They are off of gross. That is true. Yes. Yeah. So basically, as part of a SAG ultra low budget agreement, as soon as you go from first window theatrical into second window AVOD, transactional, so like iTunes, all that stuff, and streaming, which is what we're in, a percentage of the gross that's, again, pre-negotiated by the guild is the total pie. And then that pie gets sliced up based off of these points, right? But there's a specific cap on how many points you're allowed to get, which is 15. And that's because, again, pre-negotiated by the guild, say you're Brad Pitt, say you made a bajillion, paid a bajillion dollars. Statistically speaking, the majority of the pie would be yours, and every other actor would just get a little bit because you'd have a bajillion points, right? So, like I said, that's why it's capped at 15. Again, the company had it. They knew this is their bread and butter. This is what they do every single day. I was looking at this and I was like, well, I'm sure it's right, but we wanted to know. And the math wasn't totally transparent. You know what I mean? So that's the gist, everyone. If you want to know, let me know if you have any questions on residual companies.
Okay, Carlin, what do you got?
I loved a New Yorker article recently called How a Script Doctor Found His Own Voice. And it's about Scott Frank, who created The Queen's Gambit and wrote Minority Report and like a bunch of things. And
yeah, is it fair to call him a script doctor? That's like calling Carrie Fisher was
a script
doctor.
Hold, you got to read the article. Like, no. You got to read the article because this guy, his whole career, like it wasn't like, I think most of the time he was brought on to fix Minority Report. He wasn't, he's not always, he was for 40 years or whatever, maybe he's 60 something now. So like for the majority of his career until very recently, he was brought on when studios were like, oh shit, we need someone to fix this. Got to call Scott Frank. It also talks about how much money he made, which was $300,000 per week.
Yeah. Ooh, that's script doctor. I had a friend that was an assistant to a script doctor. And that's, she would tell me things like that. I was
there's
like,
no
there's
way.
No I mean, way. And then.
Sorry, guys.
Lay down for a second. But so I think if you can get past that.
I will tell you, Matt, we've had someone on the podcast before that gets paid that for script
it's doctoring. Just wild. I mean, like, look, he's at the upper echelon of that, but it talks about how he, you know, he's like, they call him like a ventriloquist because he was so good at jumping into other people's. He and Steven Soderbergh have worked together a lot, like you know how he can be sort of all these things that people need him to be, but at some point he was like, well, who am I? Kind of going back to the Orange shot list question, and just talked about how he had to start saying no to those gigs. I mean, can you imagine saying no to that kind of money? But that's how he made The Queen's Gambit. That's how he's making his next few shows. And so, and he also lives in
I guess it's a lot easier if you have been making that money for
but
a while.
Still, it's like it is hard. But you know, I just thought it was a really
you'll run out.
No, I feel
me
bad
too, poor guy. But it's a cool like peek behind the curtain, and it's also he seems like he's just so honest and vulnerable in this article, and it was just kind of fascinating to read about his journey and how where he is now and what he still struggles with and how he's kept his sanity living in Pasadena. Which I liked. I really just thought it was a great, great profile.
Kaplan, what you got?
Okay, I got a bunch of bad ones. I watched the first episode of True Detective Season 4 last night. Really enjoyed it. I freaking love an HBO show that comes on once a week. And it ends and you're like, God damn it. Now I have to wait till next week. And Kara, my wife, was like, she's like, what? Wait, how many more episodes are there? I was like, none. She's like, with just one episode? I was like, yeah, isn't it great? She's like, no, I want to know what happens next. I'm like, yes, we're going to watch it next week. Now we have something to schedule
that is great.
Sunday nights.
Is this a sequel to the previous season?
Like a new
this
iteration. No, there's not.
It's a whole new season, a new showrunner.
Cool.
Jodie Foster.
Love her.
Is the lead and takes place in Alaska. And it's just a mystery. Anyway, I like that. Next thing, I might have endorsed this before, but I kind of forgot about it and rediscovered it last week. The freaking Mr. Clean Magic Eraser. The name is so accurate.
What did your kids draw on, Warren?
I've been doing a lot of construction in the house and people carry stuff, mainly me, and bash into walls. You know, I'm sure, Carolyn, you've had a few. Like, let's move this chair into here. This,
like, oh no, these are my walls now. Crap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, where had I got to get the paint? I got to mix it. I got to like get the brush out. And then I was like about to get all the paint to like get rid of all the scuffs. And I was like, I saw a magic eraser in the pantry. I was like, wait, let me see if this works. Amazing. Work removed every single scuff.
Wow.
They are incredible. They really are. Incredible.
It is magic.
That's cool.
On the same tip of just super dumb endorsements, I'm sure 95% of people know about this, but for the 5% of you that don't, because growing up, I didn't know about this. If you light a match in the bathroom after you use it, it hides most of the smell in it.
Orin.
Yeah.
You cannot recommend a match after pooing on this podcast.
It can be anything you do in there, but why?
As a new thing he heard about.
It's not a new thing I heard about. It's a thing that I've been doing a lot lately. Look, you have to have matches in the bathroom to do this, right?
We have matches in all of our bathrooms. We only have
so
two
that's
bathrooms.
The thing. But you've been to people's houses that don't have matches, right?
We don't have matches in our bathroom.
Yeah. See, the Enlows don't poop in their house.
No, I just
invite me over and I will bring some matches and just a little match fairy leaving them little trails.
And by the way, turning a lighter on doesn't do it.
Not the same.
You need the match. And you guys put the match in the toilet, right?
This is a great endorsement. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
You don't want to put it in the trash can in case it's still secretly lit.
Sure.
Right?
I would always rinse it before I would throw any match away. I'm crazy like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I do that too.
But
yeah.
If you just throw it straight into the toilet, it's like you're rinsing it.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So even though it says don't flush anything, no sanitary napkins or whatever, you can still throw a match in there.
But a tiny match.
Yeah.
No problem. Wow, great endorsement. Wow.
Carlin, it's been great. Thank you so much. Cutting Orin off. Before he endorses washing his hands or something.
You guys do that? Okay.
This episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. Thanks, Noah. And produced, along with additional producing by Tyler Small. You can follow us across all social media and me at Just Shoot a Pod, and you can follow me at Mr. Matt Enlow.
And I'm at O'Kaplan on Instagram. You can email us at justshootapod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Let us know if you light matches after you use the restroom. And we will.
That's not the problem. The problem is acting like that's something to endorse.
My endorsements.
Let me endorse driving a car. If you need to get from one place to another.
Dude, you endorsed admitting you're wrong. Come on, man. Like, if you want to talk about obvious endorsements.
Yeah. Listen, I'll stand
I think
by
we're
that.
In the same
people,
boat.
People
I stand by the match thing. There are people who don't know about it. I'd like
I
to run the gamut.
Sleeping.
Yeah. Yeah.
Carlin, every episode with you ends with like, can I go to sleep now?
Everyone, it's 8:30 p.m. and Carlin's like,
it's 10:20. I'm so tired.
Like, I had a chamomile tea. I'm so jacked up.
Yes, I did. I had a mint medley. How do people with kids do it? Y'all are just tired all the time, I guess.
Oh, 28 hours a day.
We're it's the Hulk. We're always angry.
You're just tired all the time. Huh.
Okay, thanks everyone. We'll catch you next time.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.